Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, co-hosted by the Federalist Society's Corporations, Securities, and Antitrust and Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Groups, was recorded on Thursday, February 20th, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today we'll be discussing a pending lawsuit that concerns two government-sponsored entities, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and a lawsuit concerning those two entities. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and as usual, we are recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome today Charles Chuck Cooper. He is the founding partner of the Cooper & Kirk Law Firm here in Washington, D.C. His complete bio has been provided to you in the notice of today's call. That's also available on our website. So in the interest of getting to the discussion, I'm very brief with his introduction. He's going to speak to us for about 15 to 20 minutes in his opening remarks. He's the lone speaker today, so we're giving him a longer period of time, and this is a complicated matter. After that opening remarks, though, we're going to turn, as always, to you, the audience, for your questions, so please be ready with those questions. And with that, Mr. Cooper, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Dean. It's a pleasure to be with you this afternoon and on this important subject matter. Again, my name's Chuck Cooper. My law firm, Cooper & Kirk, represents the Fair Home Funds and the W.R. Berkley Company, which is an insurance firm, and a number of other private preferred shareholders of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in lawsuits against the federal government for unlawful actions that the government has taken to nationalize Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Our suit is not the only lawsuit. There are, at least by my latest count, 10 lawsuits pending in the district court arguing APA violations, that is, violations of the Administrative Procedure Act and other common law claims and causes of action. 7 cases pending in the Court of Federal Claims, which are seeking recovery against the government under takings theories, and 1 case pending in Iowa District Court, also bringing APA and other types of fiduciary duty claims and what have you. So there's a total of 18 lawsuits, by our count anyway, pending now that basically allege the same gravamen. Now, while there is a debate that has been raging now for many years in this country and in particular in Congress right now over what the future of Fannie and Freddie should look like. But the one thing that everyone should agree on, I would submit, is that any changes that are to take place at Fannie and Freddie must be accomplished in accordance with the rule of law and therefore must respect the property rights of Fannie and Freddie's existing private shareholders. And as the conservator of Fannie and Freddie, the Federal Housing Finance Agency, has itself acknowledged, the only outcome that the FHFA, the conservator that is, the FHFA, may implement under existing law is to reconstitute those two companies under their current charters. So once that conservatorship is complete, the only authority it has under existing law by its own admission is to reconstitute those companies. Unfortunately, that's not what has happened. On August 17, 2012, the federal government effectively nationalized Fannie and Freddie, expropriating to itself the profits generated by the companies and wiping out tens of billions of dollars invested in those companies by private shareholders. The nationalization of Fannie and Freddie was effected by essentially a backroom interagency agreement between FHFA, the conservator, and the Treasury Department that ignored express and very specific limits on the statutory authority vested in the FHA and the Department of Treasury, and also violated the fiduciary duties that FHFA owed to Fannie and Freddie's shareholders. Now, to really fully grasp the gravamen of our claims, it's important to, in some detail, outline what the background of the of this nationalization of Fannie and Freddie was. Now, Fannie and Freddie, they were chartered by Congress, and they're often referred to as government-sponsored enterprises. But they are, or at least they were until August 2012, for-profit entities owned by private shareholders. By 2007, Fannie and Freddie had been consistently profitable for decades, but the crisis in the housing market took a toll on Fannie and Freddie's balance sheets, as it did on the balance sheets of many other, most other entities that were involved in the nation's housing and mortgage banking industry. In response to that crisis, Congress enacted emergency legislation called the Housing and Economic Recovery Act of 2008, otherwise known as HERA, and that's how I will refer to it throughout this call. But HERA created a new regulator, FHFA. And it authorized that regulator to place Fannie and Freddie and certain other regulated entities, but Fannie and Freddie for our purposes, into either conservatorship or receivership, depending upon whether very specific statutory criteria had been satisfied. And it also gave the Treasury Department temporary authority to purchase Fannie and Freddie's securities. Its equity securities, but that authority expired on December 31, 2007. HERA draws a very clear distinction, and this is quite important, between the powers and the responsibilities of FHFA when it is acting as a conservator and when it is acting as a receiver of Fannie and Freddie. Its own regulations say this: as conservator, FHFA is authorized under HERA to take such action as may be necessary to put the regulated entity in a sound and solvent condition and appropriate to carry on the business of the regulated entity and to preserve and conserve the assets and property of the regulated entity. FHFA's own regulations also make clear that the conservator's goal, and I'm quoting again, is to continue the operations of a regulated entity, rehabilitate it, and return it to a safe, sound, and solvent condition. And this is in contrast to the FHFA's authorities as a receiver, again, from the FHFA's own regulations. The ultimate responsibility of FHFA as receiver is to resolve and liquidate the existing entity. Now, on September 6, 2008, FHFA placed Fannie and Freddie into conservatorship, quite deliberately, not receivership. In other words, the agency made the deliberate decision not to wind down and liquidate the companies, but rather, and these are its words, to help restore confidence in the companies and to put them in a sound and solvent condition. The director of FHFA at the time, James Lockhart, explained publicly at the time that the conservatorship, and these are his words, is a statutory process designed to stabilize Fannie and Freddie with the objective of returning the entities to normal business operations. FHFA will act as conservator to operate the companies, he said, until they are stabilized. So the FHFA specifically and publicly denied any notion that it was placing the companies in receivership. And this is what it said at the time. Receivership is a statutory process for liquidation of a regulated entity. The conservator cannot make a determination to liquidate the companies. And it further emphasized there are no plans to liquidate the companies. Now, especially important of the public comments that the conservator at the time, FHFA, made about the property rights of existing private shareholders. It made clear that those property rights were preserved under conservatorship, and it published some publicly distributed questions and answers, and this is one of those questions. Question: what happens to the company's stock during the conservatorship? Answer: during the conservatorship, the company's stock will continue to trade. However, by statute, the powers of the stockholders are suspended until the conservatorship is terminated. Stockholders will continue to retain all rights in the stock's financial worth, as such worth is determined by the market. And later, in testimony to Congress, Director Lockhart elaborated the point. He said, the shareholders are still in place. Both the preferred and common shareholders have an economic interest in the companies. And going forward, there may be some value. So it was very clear from the outset what the purpose of the conservatorship was, and that its purpose was to stabilize and return these companies to normal business operations and to preserve stockholder interest in those companies. On September 7th, the FHFA, and that was at the same time this conservatorship was created, it entered into agreements with Treasury Department that provided funding or capitalization of the Fannie and Freddie in exchange for a new class of senior preferred stock in the company. I'm going to call that the government stock. Treasury committed to provide up to $200 billion in funding to each of the companies to ensure that they maintain the positive net worth. So at any time that their a quarter ended with their liquid, their liabilities exceeding their assets, the government committed to provide money to bring that net worth up to a positive, or at least a zero net worth. Now, in return for that government stock, Treasury was entitled to have the senior most liquidation preference. So it had a preference over, obviously, the existing private preferred or the common stock, and to an annual dividend that could be paid in one of two ways. And this is important. The companies could either pay the dividend in cash, equal to 10% of the value of Treasury's liquidation preference, which, by the way, started at $1 billion for each company and increased by $1 for each dollar that the companies drew down from Treasury's funding commitment. But the second method that Fannie and Freddie could pay dividends was that they had the option of paying Treasury a 12% in-kind dividend. That is to say, a dividend of additional preferred stock rather than cash, the only difference being that it had a slightly higher interest rate, 12% rather than 10. And finally, the deal called for Treasury to get warrants that entitled it to buy 79.9% of each company's common stock for a very nominal price. So ultimately, the government would be the 80%, essentially 80% owner of these companies' equity, common stock. So from 2007 until when the conservatorship was created till 2011, as the nation struggled to recover from the housing crisis, Fannie and Freddie consistently drew upon this funding commitment. As a result, by the end of the first quarter of 2012, the aggregate liquidation preference of Treasury's government stock was approximately $189 billion. Now, $26 billion of that of that liquidation preference was attributable to draws that Fannie and Freddie had made, or FHFA had made, in order to pay Treasury cash dividends on its government stock. In other words, the companies drew $26 billion from Treasury only to turn right around and pay it back to Treasury. But as I mentioned earlier, the companies were under no obligation to make these draws because they could have paid the dividends in kind rather than in cash. But as the housing market recovered, so did the profitability of Fannie and Freddie. In August 2012, the companies announced that they had returned to profitability. And for the quarter ending in June 2012, they'd made a combined $8 billion in profit, some $3 billion more than necessary to service in cash their dividend obligation to Treasury. It was also clear by then that Fannie and Freddie had greatly overestimated their reserves for loan losses and deferred tax assets, and that those excess reserves would gradually be reversed and taken into earnings. Less than 2 weeks after Fannie and Freddie's announcement that they had returned to stable profitability, the government returned to its back room and it agreed with itself to unilaterally revise its interagency agreement. This time, it expropriated all of Fannie and Freddie's profit for itself, and it therefore extinguished the property rights of all existing shareholders, both preferred and common, existing private shareholders. On August 17, 2012, FHFA and Treasury amended the preferred stock agreement to eliminate the government's 10% cash dividend and to replace it with a new dividend that was equal to Fannie and Freddie's entire net worth. That is 100% of any profits that either of these entities made going forward in perpetuity would be paid to the government under what it called this net worth sweep. Treasury emphasized even at the time in August 2012, that this new amendment to the stock agreement, that the quarterly sweep of every dollar of profit that each firm earns going forward would make sure that every dollar of earnings of Fannie and Freddie would be used to benefit taxpayers. And the Treasury also announced at the time that the net worth sweep ensures, and again, these are Treasury's own words, ensures that Fannie and Freddie will be wound down and will not be allowed to retain profits, rebuild capital, and return to the market in their prior form. So a complete reversal of the purposes of the conservatorship as publicly announced and that the public was assured at the time the conservatorship was created, and a complete evisceration of all rights of the private shareholders. Again, perfectly contrary to the assurances made at the time that the conservatorship was created. And the only thing that had happened between that period of time is that these entities were no longer zombies, not making profits, in fact losing money, but were now very profitable. And in fact, Fannie and Freddie enjoyed record-breaking profitability since the imposition of net worth sweep. For the year 2012, they reported a net income of $17.2 billion and $11 billion, respectively. Through the first three quarters of 2013, the companies were even more profitable, with Fannie reporting net income of $77.5 billion and Freddie some $40 billion. All of those earnings have been paid to the Treasury under the net worth sweep. And those profits reflect, in part, the reversal of accounting decisions that I mentioned earlier that had led Fannie and Freddie to experience large non-cash losses during the housing crisis. For example, Fannie released almost $51 billion of the company's deferred tax assets valuation allowance in the first quarter of 2013, and it was required by the net worth sweep to pay all that money in cash to the Treasury. Freddie did a very similar reversal of its deferred tax assets, equaling almost $24 billion in the third quarter of 2013, and all of that money was paid to Treasury under the net worth sweep. So Fannie and Freddie have now repaid the Treasury dividends that total approximately $185 billion, which amounts to nearly all of the approximately $187 billion in capital that Treasury had provided in taxpayer funds to these companies. So they are just short of paying back every dollar that they've received during their time of crisis, received from the taxpayer. Yet the liquidation preference that the government claims on its government stock remains at $189 billion. It hasn't been reduced a dime. And the company's profits will continue to be swept to Treasury in perpetuity, no matter how much money they make or how profitable they are. So the benefits of the net worth sweep to the government have been, to say the least, enormous. But they've come at the expense of simply a disregard for the law and for the duties that are owed to Fannie and Freddie's private shareholders. Now, our time, if at least for me to outline the background of this, is too short to get into the detail with respect to all of the causes of action. The one point I want to make here before opening up to questions and answers is that a central claim in the actions now pending in the district court in D.C. and one pending in the district court in Iowa argues that the net worth sweep violates the Administrative Procedure Act, or actually the net worth sweep is in excess of statutory authority or otherwise not in accordance with law as the APA itself prescribes. And the law that the net worth sweep is not in accordance with is HERA itself. The very specific requirements that the statute places upon FHFA as conservator to preserve and conserve the assets of the company, to return it to a safe and solvent condition and to stabilize it. And ultimately, as FHFA very clearly publicly announced when it created the conservatorship, to return it to normal business operations. It's difficult to imagine anything more directly contrary to those responsibilities, those authorities as conservator, than the complete dissipation of all profits affected by the net worth sweep, the prevention of Fannie and Freddie from rebuilding their capital, from returning to stable and normal business operations. There are a number of other concerns that have been violations of HERA that have been alleged in these cases. For example, the net worth sweep itself took place after the authority of Treasury to purchase equity, additional securities, had expired in 2009. And really the only way to view the net worth sweep is as a conversion of the government's preferred stock into common stock. That is a new equity security. And its authority to do anything such as that had expired. Again, there are a number of other claims, but I will subside now with this description of the background of the cases and the general gravamen of them, and open up to questions, Dean.
Thank you very much. It's been very, very interesting so far. But let's do open it up for questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, you push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are completely open at this point. while we're waiting to see who might ring in, let me make our typical programming announcement. The calendar is fluid, so I advise you to go to the website and check for updates. But as of right now, on Monday next week, we will host Rob Gassaway of Kirkland & Ellis, who's going to attend the oral argument on Monday in the much-anticipated greenhouse gas case being argued in the court on Monday, and then host a telephone call for us at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. On Wednesday, we're going to host another Courthouse Steps version of Teleforum covering yet another important patent case, the Octane Fitness case, and that's on Wednesday at a time to be determined. But today, of course, we're speaking with Chuck Cooper about the GSE litigation. Our lines are open for questions. Push the star button and the pound button if you have a question. And while we're waiting to see who might ring in, let me ask you, if I could, Chuck, what is the government's defense of the net worth sweep? And in connection with that, were there any contemporaneous discussions within the halls of the regulators about the legality of the total net worth sweep? That is, did they consider the legal angles of this, or did they just consider the policy angles?
Well, before answering those questions, Dean, and thank you for asking them, but I want to make clear something I really should have said at the outset. Maybe some questions that are asked here that I won't be able to answer in light of the fact that these cases are obviously in active litigation, and to the extent questions range into matters that are privileged or otherwise confidential or relate to litigation strategy either by me and my colleagues and our clients or by our fellow co-counsel representing other clients in these lawsuits, obviously I won't be able to range into those areas, but I'll certainly try to answer all questions as completely as I can. And as to your question, the current status of the cases, Dean, is that motions to dismiss have been filed in the district court cases and in the takings cases over in the Court of Federal Claims. And the core defense for the net worth sweep that has been offered by the government, both the Department of Treasury and the FHFA, is the argument that the net worth sweep was necessary, that amendment was necessary to preserve the funding commitment for that Treasury had committed to. Again, it was up to $200 billion for each of the companies, preserve that funding commitment over the long haul, and that so long as the companies were drawing down on that commitment, cash draws in order to turn around and pay the 10% cash dividend that was due and owing on what now is $189 billion of liquidation preference, as long as they were that they had that dividend obligation, they would be drawing down money to pay it if the record profitability that they're now enjoying levels out or they experience some type of reversals, which may or may not be in the cards in the future. But the central problem with that argument, well, there's two. One is it really blinks at the reality that Fannie and Freddie are right now again experiencing record profitability, and the only thing that had happened from the time that the conservatorships were created and the original deal was put in place, the 10% dividend deal, and the time that the net worth sweep was put in place to eliminate the 10% dividend was that the companies became very profitable. The conservatorship had succeeded. They had returned to profitability. And so the reason for doing what Treasury and FHFA did was it either no longer existed or it was nowhere near as intense and as important as it might have been in the days when before Fannie and Freddie had returned to profitability. But the real answer to this defense is that at no time have Fannie and Freddie been required under their contractual deal with Treasury to pay dividends in cash. It is really quite remarkable to us that Fannie and Freddie and FHFA entered into this circular process in which they borrowed cash from Treasury to turn around and pay cash dividends, when their agreements made very clear that that was not necessary and presumably wasn't contemplated unless they actually had generated the cash to do it through operations. They clearly had the option of paying dividends in kind, again, paying Treasury additional preferred stock at the rate of 12%, but not cash. So that's the central flaw in the government's core defense.
Well, and the second part of my question was, is there any indication yet, or is it too soon to know, that there were internal deliberations about the legality of the net worth sweep, or were they just not paying attention to that, or what's your sense of that?
Dean, in the district court case where the APA claims are pending, the government has produced the administrative record, that is supposed to contain everything that the government's decision makers relied upon in making the decision to amend the original stock agreements and put the net worth sweep in place. We, my client, Fairholme, and Berkeley have believed that administrative record is woefully deficient, and we have asked the district court judge to permit supplementation, or to require supplementation of that administrative record, and permit us to take some limited discovery in order to go behind the administrative record to determine what else should be in it. But there's some very glaring omissions from the administrative record. One of them is anything, truly reflecting that they did deal with the legal issues that at least we believe, are raised on the face of the decision to install this net worth sweep.
Once again, we're talking to Mr. Charles Cooper. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. Another argument I've heard, and reading up on this a bit, is that this whole arrangement arose from extraordinary times, and that maybe the typical legal definitions of conservatorship don't apply here, that that's not exactly what was intended, a classic conservatorship, that duties aren't quite the same here, more duty is owed to the taxpayer, not to the exclusion of the shareholders, but I've also heard that if it weren't for the bailout, the shareholders would get nothing because the enterprises would have failed entirely. I wonder if you want to talk about either of those points for a bit.
Yeah. Well, Dean, the authorities and the requirements or obligations on FHFA, if it places a regulated entity into conservatorship, are very clearly prescribed by the statute under which it is acting, HERA. And, you know, that those provisions are, in many of them, are closely similar and have been drawn from other statutes that have existed for many years, establishing, for example, FDIC's ability to place a regulated bank into a receivership or a conservatorship, the authority of the former OTS, Office of Thrift Supervision, to place a savings and loan into conservatorship or receivership. These provisions are not strange provisions. They're quite familiar and akin to these pre-existing authorities in these very analogous areas. And there's a body of case law that's grown up under those pre-existing provisions, which we think are very strongly supportive of the claims that we're making here. But the bottom line is that FHFA cannot do as conservator anything which the statute doesn't authorize it to do, and that's the key. And our view is that its authorities are quite clear that it can only conserve and preserve the entity. It can only seek to stabilize it, restore it to normal operations. But it certainly can't do precisely the opposite of that, and it can't under the guise of a conservatorship install what we have called, a de facto slow motion receivership.
I take it at the outset they could have gone into receivership. They could have elected that. And are we saying that the decision to go into conservatorship once made is irrevocable?
Well, two things. First, whether the conditions existed for them to put Fannie and Freddie into receivership back in September 2007, that's not something that we've taken a position on.
Right.
But even if you assume that those conditions would have been satisfied, and presumably they weren't, because there are certain requirements that make receivership mandatory, statutorily required. But FHFA didn't do that. It placed Fannie and Freddie in conservatorship. And the statutory authority for it to do so is, as I mentioned at the outset, very different and it is quite specific under HERA itself. So, and your second question, Dean, whether or not the decision to place a regulated entity such as Fannie and Freddie in conservatorship, whether that can't be undone. Well, of course it can. If the circumstances which led to the creation of a conservatorship deteriorate, and the regulated entity becomes or its condition satisfies the very specific requirements under HERA for placing an entity in receivership, it can then go ahead and convert conservatorship into a receivership and call upon its new and different authorities and responsibilities as the receiver, one of which is that it must liquidate the entity. It must, in an orderly process, liquidate the entity, gathering its assets and liquidating them, and obviously making whole as many of the creditors and ultimately the stockholders as it possibly can. But as it does so, it has to honor the priority scheme, which is another very specific requirement of liquidation. But if right now it's very clear and for quite a while now, the circumstances that could possibly justify a receivership have no longer exist.
Okay. It looks like we do have a question from the audience. Let's take our first question.
Yes, it's David Emerson, Society member here in Berkeley. I've actually got a couple of questions. Hello? Hello?
We can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah, thanks. I got a couple questions. One has to do with whether or not we're actually going to be creating a new body of law here having to do with enterprises that are too big to fail, and whether at least the speaker believes that this can be resolved within the framework of existing law, or there's going to be an entirely new form of administrative law having to do with these special cases. This one, AIG, the bailouts of GM, all areas where there were extra legal or arguably extra legal government activities. The second question is a more specific one, and that both Fannie and Freddie, in that they're public companies, have public disclosures which are filed with the SEC. And from what little I know, there's been some disclosure in those filings as to the general nature of the relationship of the payback of the government's advances of funds. But as far as I can tell, it hasn't been at the degree of specificity which would have given a shareholder fair warning of what was coming down. But I don't have the background on this, and I'd like to get the speaker's perspective on the SEC disclosure, its adequacy, the strengths, weaknesses, and whether or not that is and also an aspect of the litigation.
Sure. Thank you. Well, first, with respect to whether or not a new body of public law is in the making here, dealing with extraordinary circumstances, I do not believe so. Our lawsuit, the lawsuit of the others who we're allied with in these now 17 lawsuits challenging at least the net worth sweep, and some of the lawsuits challenge the conservatorship itself, but focusing just on the net worth sweep, we believe that the rule of law as it has been established by Congress in HERA is more than adequate to resolve these disputes, and that, you know, pure and simple, when the Treasury and FHFA decided that they wanted not 10% of the, not a 10% dividend on their funding, but they wanted all the profits going forward. And no telling how many billions and billions of dollars over and above the amount that Treasury put into these entities in order to recapitalize them. When they made that decision, they exceeded the legitimate authorities that Congress had provided to them. And it will be up to the courts to determine whether or not that's true. But when you look at what they said at the time they created the conservatorship, they knew exactly what those limitations were. They knew exactly what those obligations were and the purposes of that conservatorship were, and the fact that existing private shareholders' property rights were to be preserved if that conservatorship succeeded. And then as soon as it succeeded, they reversed all of that. They went against and the best argument for their unlawful behavior comes from their own mouths when they established conservatorship itself. So we don't think a new body of public, we certainly hope that the courts aren't going to create a new body of public law here, because they will have to. They will have to create new law, and they will have to create law that is different from the law that Congress created in HERA, if the government is to succeed in these cases. With respect to the disclosures, One of the most troubling aspects of this case, you know, as you dig into it. I'm sorry? One of the most troubling aspects to many of us of the case is what now is emerging. And there was a very fine article just the other day in the New York Times by Gretchen Morgenson drawing attention to this. But it's now emerging that it was clear within the government, emerging from their own internal documents that they've supplied to us in these lawsuits, that it was clear that they had come to a decision contrary to the publicly announced purposes of the conservatorship when it was created in 2007. They had come to a decision at least as early as 2010 that they were not going to allow the private shareholders to participate in any profits going forward or any value from Fannie and Freddie going forward, no matter how profitable, no matter how profitable those entities became, and no matter how much money over and above the investment that Treasury put into them that it ultimately reaped. It's clear as early as February of 2010 that the government had committed itself not to allow that to happen. There were no disclosures of that. Private shareholders who had heard what Mr. Lockhart had to say, who in 2007 when the conservatorship was created, who had heard what Treasury had to say at that time, and had heard that their holdings were not being wiped out, to the contrary, were being preserved, and that the purpose here of the government would be ultimately to return those companies to private shareholders, and again, hopefully, if it succeeded, as it has, to restore that value. And this is exactly what happened in, for example, other bailouts. The questioner asked about, I think, AIG and perhaps some others, but in the AIG bailout, the private shareholders were not wiped out. They just as at least the government proclaimed here at the time they created the conservatorship for Fannie and Freddie. So we believe the disclosure requirements of existing law are robust, and if they are abided by, would provide shareholders with fair notes. What we have here, though, is a government that the only disclosures it made to shareholders put them at ease that their holdings would not be wiped out.
Okay, we do have another. I'm sorry, we do have a question from another audience member. Did you have a follow-up question in Berkeley?
Yeah, but suggest that there will be a parallel securities fraud case against Fannie Freddie alongside the conservatorship issues.
I guess that remains to be seen. I suspect that there are some there's some consideration being given to that in a number of quarters, but I don't have any specific information as to whether any such lawsuits will be forthcoming, at least at this time.
Thank you.
Let's take another question, and a reminder, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Yes, the question I have, and I'm sorry, my name is John Nguyen, and I own several of these instruments, and I own the class, that is, the complete class, according to the prospectus. So the question I have is, one, how does this affect the residual class? That's one. And then two, I wanted to follow up a little more on the fraud situation that the last questionnaire asked. And not so much in with the SEC, but just criminal fraud itself for material misrepresentation. It's my understanding, and you see this on a smaller scale, when people get several loans against their home, okay, and essentially the way I see it is Fannie Freddie got a loan from the government, okay? However, Fannie Freddie borrowed the money to pay the government back their money, which I don't quite understand, especially since we were first in. So if you can kind of expand upon both of those for me, I'd really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Linden. And I'm assuming that when you say the residual class, you're talking about the common stock owner?
Well, I wouldn't say common. I would say RRS class. I mean, I've delved into these pretty deeply. And looking at the prospectus, and just case in point on one of mine, you know, you've got A, B, C, D, all the way down to Z, Z, S class, L, L, B, and then you start talking about residual class, okay? So, you know, in looking at all of them, okay, and I follow Freddie on their website, you know, quite religiously, and looking at where they're at on the tranches of payment, okay, and I see movement, but we don't know who that movement's to. Case in point is, you know, there's 213 million left hanging on my combined CUSIPs, okay? However, I know for a fact I'm not receiving it. So when I look at the monthly spread of, let's say, 0.29 that we're supposed to be receiving, okay, I see the pay down on the tranche payments, on the tranche schedule on the Freddie site. That's one. Two, it doesn't match what my broker dealers are seeing on Bloomberg, okay? And it's definitely not being being put into my account. Now, when I call Freddie, because in effect they are the servicing agent, you know, they tell me talk to Treasury.
Yeah, you know, Mr. Lynn, I am sorry, but I just don't think I'm competent to answer your question. I'm not familiar with the concerns that that you are raising. It is my understanding that there's about $33 billion of preferred stock outstanding, and that it all of that preferred stock is entitled to the same preference by way of payment. In other words, none of the various series have a preference over another series, but all of them together preference over the common, of course. But I just don't know at the retail level about the concerns that you're raising, so I apologize.
That's right. Actually, according to the issuance of the prospectus, these were both PCs. So even with the common shares, according to when they were issued in 92 and 93, even preferred stock was not to be paid out above common stock. They were supposed to retire the CUSIP, is my understanding. But
okay,
we really can't speak about it, then, you know, it's kind of a moot point.
Let me break in here and note that we've got a couple minutes left here, Chuck, and we don't have any other questions pending, but let me give you a minute or two to wrap up if you'd like, or express a final thought here.
Well, thank you, Dean, and thanks again to the Federalist Society for hosting this call and on, you know, this very important matter and this very extraordinary series of events relating to Fannie and Freddie. I think in wrapping up, I would only say that the private shareholders of Fannie and Freddie are clinging to the rule of law as they now appeal to the courts to seek relief for the destruction of the property rights that they have long held, and that, again, when the government stepped in and created conservatorship in 2008, the government itself made clear that their rights would continue to be preserved so long as the conservatorship was ultimately successful. And it has now been successful, but the government unfortunately has completely reversed its position on that, and we think in a way that is really quite inconsistent with its obligations under its governing statute, as well as its basic fiduciary obligations as a conservator of two privately owned corporate entities. So with that, Dean, again, thank you very much for hosting this call.
Well, and my thanks to you, Mr. Charles Cooper of the Cooper & Kirk Law Firm here in D.C. Fascinating set of cases, and I hope we can have you back as things progress and look for further updates. To our audience, a reminder to join Monday's Courthouse Steps Teleforum on the greenhouse gas cases, but until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.